This is WFHB, Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also at 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org. We're coming up here at 5 o'clock. It's about 78 degrees and partly cloudy skies in South Central Indiana. Tonight, a low of 55 degrees and clear skies. Stay tuned. Coming up next, it's the Daily Local News right here on WFHB.
You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer-powered,
listener-supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wagermiller. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, May 8th, 2018.
You have 82 different ballots, but times two because one's Republican and one's Democrat, so we really have 164 different ballots plus two extra.
Today is primary election day. Later in the program, we'll hear from Monroe County Election Supervisor Karen Wheeler about new figures on voter turnout today and managing the county's 34 polling sites. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Glenda Murray talks about Maud Showers and the Showers Complex in Bloomington. That story is coming up in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
The Bloomington Redevelopment Commission reviewed two projects last night that will improve connectivity in the city, though in different ways. Commission members gave their final approval for the city's purchase of the IU Health Hospital site at 2nd and Rogers Streets. The Bloomington City Council already approved the agreement. Because the 24-acre redevelopment project will span over 3 years and cost well over $5 million, the Redevelopment Commission must give final approval on the deal. Bloomington Controller Jeff Underwood recapped the purchase agreement for the property's four parcels.
That agreement with the hospital is they will demo the hospital proper, except for the old core administration building, which is the original hospital, the oldest section, and the parking garage. The city has 1 year to review that option and make a determination whether to keep those facilities or not. At that point, then, the hospital, once it has transferred all operations to the new hospital, will be required to demo that and return it to us as a green site. There are specifications in that so that we don't get sinkholes and, you know, it basically will follow the topography, drain well, and then the city will make the second payment at that time. We have the ability to inspect that work as well as do environmental investigations on it and the other three sites as well. The buildings on the B, C, and D would come to the Redevelopment Commission and we would be allowed to do what we wanted with those, as long as none of the parcels can be used as a direct competitor or sold to a direct competitor of the hospital.
Various appraisals place the value of the 24-acre property from $10 to $16 million. The city agreed to buy the IU Health Hospital property for $6.5 million. That purchase is expected to be paid in three installments.
The commission also heard a proposal from Public Investment Corporation for a new roadway to replace Weimer Road between West 2nd Street and Tap Road. Under the proposal, Weimer Road would become a bike path. The proposed project is part of the corporation's development of the Mill Creek planned unit development on West Tap Road. Steve Brehab of engineering firm Smith Brehab & Associates described the new street plan.
We've worked quite a bit with the City Planning and Transportation Department, and that roadway would have two 10-foot lanes and then a 7-foot bike lane on each side, 6.5-foot tree plots, and 5-foot sidewalk on each side.
The development on West Tap Road also calls for an east-west road to be built through the area. Brehab also said a wooded area containing trails from Wapahani Bike Park would be given back to the city's Parks Department. The development skirts the eastern side of the Wapahami Bike Park.
The other thing that we'll most likely do is have pedestrian connections from the road through into the trails in the mountain bike park, and then following the road, and then a connection on out here to Weimer Road. So eventually, when Weimer becomes a bike path or pedestrian path, then you'd be able to go through this development to get to Wapahani as well.
The Redevelopment Commission approved the city paying $250,000 to the developer toward the road construction. Controller Jeff Underwood said the city is getting a good bang for its buck.
We get three valuable things for this contribution. Is eventually the street will connect and take out a very bad corner. That can then be dedicated to a pedestrian way that connects with the trail, extensive trail system to the north and south of that. And then we get the conservation easements. And in addition to that, then we have access that will get for us to connect those trails up through the Wapahani Park.
Road construction is expected to begin this fall.
The Bloomington Redevelopment Commission has approved three neighborhood improvement grants totaling $17,000. In the commission's Saturday meeting, program manager Vicki Provine said one of the grants will provide 192 children with back-to-school supplies. The Back-to-School Bash initiative is run by the Bloomington Housing Authority Resident Council.
And they buy backpacks, and they put hygiene items in them and different items that the children will need for school. So when the children up in the Crestmont area are going back to school, they're going to have items that they need for school along with school supplies.
The remaining grants will fund signage in two Bloomington neighborhoods.
Gentry Estates is wanting to put up another sign. A couple years ago, they came to you and did a limestone site at their one entrance, and they want the same sign to be located in their second entrance. And then Prospect Hill neighborhood is looking at Rose Hill as kind of a park in their area. A lot of people go over there to walk and enjoy the cemetery. So they're wanting to make some improvements, and they're wanting to put up a sign for a historic factor about the cemetery. And then they're also looking at getting a bench this year.
Provine said the long-running neighborhood improvement grants fund projects other city programs don't cover.
These started in 98, so we are on our 20 year of doing neighborhood grants. And we have grants, counting these, there'll be 92 grants that have been funded in our neighborhoods. So it shows you all the good work that our neighborhoods do.
In addition to neighborhood signage, past grants have funded playground equipment, landscaping, and the restoration of historic sidewalks.
New data shows that Indiana aired more commercials than any other state in the nation this primary season. WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester brings us this report.
Indiana spent more on political advertising this primary election than any other state in the nation. According to an analysis by the Wesleyan Media Project, Indiana candidates have spent $8.8 million on ads this primary season. That's $2 million more than the second-place spender, Ohio. Indiana also aired more political advertisements than any other state participating in the elections, coming in at just over 34,000 broadcast ads since January. Looking at the expenditures by party, GOP candidates have run approximately 21,000 campaign ads this election, 29,000 if you include ads by other political entities such as political action committees or PACs. By comparison, Indiana Democratic candidates have only run approximately 1,300 ads since January, 5,000 if you add in support ads from Democratic political groups. Travis Ridout is one of the co-directors of the Wesleyan Media Project and has been tracking campaign advertising records for the past several months. Ridow says that, especially in Indiana, it's not surprising that we've been seeing far more spending from Republican candidates than Democratic ones.
For instance, in Indiana's Senate race, or the race for the Democratic nomination, it really isn't a contest. The incumbent doesn't have to run ads at this point, or at least too many ads, in order to win the nomination, whereas you've got that really hot race for the GOP nomination, and so the candidates have been having to introduce themselves to the voters early.
Ridow says the increased spending on campaigns can be partially attributed to recent special elections across the country, which saw several Republicans lose their seats. This resulted in a dramatic increase in campaign spending. Total campaign advertising volumes this year are anticipated to be almost 90% more than in the last midterm primary election in 2014.
I think one of the reasons we've seen that increase in spending in political advertising is that there have been some special elections this past year that have really been hotly contested. Those have been seen as signs, will the Democrats do well in 2018 or will Republicans do well in 2018? So they've been pouring millions and millions into that Senate race in Alabama and the special election in Georgia and Pennsylvania. So part of it has to do with that. Part of it is we've seen a lot of really tightly contested nomination races, especially on the Republican side. We've got a lot of Democratic incumbents running in, frankly, Republican states. And so Republicans are seeing opportunity there. And so a lot of them are vying for the Republican nomination. But in order to win that nomination, they got to, you know, hit their opponents with those negative ads and build up their own name recognition and reputation. So those two factors combined, I think, are leading to an increase in spending this year.
In Indiana, political groups, like political action committees, make up a large portion of campaign advertising. According to the Wesleyan study, approximately one-third of all ads in Indiana this year were created by political groups. While some of these entities interact directly with political campaigns, many of them are considered unaffiliated and have no official contact with candidates.
We definitely know there's been more involvement of outside groups like super PACs in the past couple of election cycles, the past three election cycles, than what we saw, say, a decade ago. And they tend to be entering into the races earlier than they were in the past, too. And so in many of these primary races, especially on the Republican side, we've been seeing a lot of advertising from outside groups.
Ridout says Indiana residents can expect even more political advertising during the 2018 general election than in past years. Ridout says fewer advertisements will air during summer, but residents can expect a steady increase in political ads as the general election gets closer. If this primary cycle has proved anything, says Ridout, it's that television advertisements still dominate political advertising spending.
I think the big takeaway is just that TV advertising is still very important. It's especially important in nomination races and all these people who kind of doubt its importance, who say we're moving to a digital world. Well, we are, but TV advertising remains very, very important, and millions of dollars are still being poured into it.
This primary election has been particularly brutal for Indiana's GOP, which is seeing a three-way fight for the nomination of a Republican candidate for one of Indiana's Senate seats. Congressmen Todd Rakita and Luke Messer and former state representative Mike Braun are competing to see who will run against Democratic incumbent Joe Donnelly in this year's general election. The Indianapolis Star reports that, as of May 3rd, the Republican candidates spent a combined $5 million on political advertising on radio and TV since January. Rakita and Messer both spent approximately $1.2 million, and Braun spent over $3 million, more than both of his opponents combined. According to the Star, the candidates are expected to have spent an additional $1 million in the final week leading up to today's election. For WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Erin Wagermiller.
And I'm Don Guerra. Today is primary election day, and Monroe County Elections Supervisor Karen Wheeler says residents have turned out in much higher numbers than the last midterm primary election back in 2014. Here, Wheeler speaks with WFHB News Director Wes Martin about the organizing and turnout of today's election.
This is Karen Wheeler, and I am Monroe County Election Supervisor. As you know, today's been amazing. Right now, I have 14,758 Monroe residents that have voted. That is early voting as well as election day. That's 16% of the registered voters.
Would you imagine that number to continue increasing or increase at a faster rate as people leave work and head to the polls?
We could have a bump in those 2 hours, yes, of those almost at 15,000. 5,500 of that was early voting. So we've done pretty well on what we think a midterm election is.
Just to put things into context, how does that compare to those final numbers for the previous primaries in 2014?
They are considerably higher. Let me get my numbers there. On primary for 2014, we had a total vote of 7,352. 5,549 were on election day in walk-in military and travel board was 1,803 this year. If you combine all those, it was that 5,500.
Just to say again, what percentage of registered voters voted today so far? You said 16%?
Yes, 16%.
And how does that stack up against 2014?
Pretty sure it's 7%.
So already we've more than doubled and the polls have not yet closed today.
Yes.
Okay.
In 14, our registered numbers that we had registered voters is 104,195. So we had a higher number of registered voters. Right now we have 92,000. So that plays into it too.
And Ms. Wheeler, anything else that you think people should know?
Yeah, no, I think we're doing good. I'll say, okay, I can give you another percentage. So election day at this point, we've had 66% vote on election day and 34% for early or absentee ballots. Seeing, I think, every year that the early voting number is increasing, not greatly, you know, real fast, but it is. People are beginning to do that more, but obviously election day is still the winner, if you want to call it that. People still like doing the election day. At 2014, we had about 5,500 total votes, and right now we're at about 12,000, so it's a much bigger race.
Okay, so yesterday we had talked, and the original number of early voters was, I think, estimated somewhere a little over 5,000 voters, maybe 5,030
right.
Or something.
That was really incorrect. It was misinformation. So early voting in 2014 was 1,803 total for the election. In 2014 was 5,549.
And just to be clear, we're talking about those two elections, particularly because they're both midterm elections?
Correct.
So again, you had mentioned that this year, the number that we had received yesterday is significantly lower than... that means that a lot more people early voted this year than in previous years.
The information was incorrect. Everything is fine. It just was read incorrectly.
Okay, so we're getting a much higher voter turnout, both it looks like in the one for this primary election, but also in terms of early voting numbers. Now, did you see an increase in the number of absentee ballots that were also cast?
Yes. So it went from early voting in 14 was 1,800, and we would have over 5,000, 5,500, maybe even 6,000. Some of these numbers haven't gotten put in here yet, so it's considerably up.
Voting, have you heard of long wait times or anything, any machines going down?
No, I would say in general, it seems like the polls are fairly slow. There we have some that are steady, yeah. No long lines, no waits anywhere that I know of. I haven't heard of anything. Some are very quiet, and then there's those that keep pushing them through.
And polls don't close until 6 o'clock tonight. Mm-hmm. If people are in line at 6 o'clock, can they still vote?
Absolutely.
I'm just wondering how many people were hired and how many volunteers you've needed in order to...
It would probably be close to 300.
300 volunteers?
Yes, you say volunteers, but they are paid. If they work a poll site and that is their polling site, they can vote there. If that is not their poll site, then they need to vote early to get their vote in. 9 out of 34 poll sites have just that one precinct. The rest have multiple precincts. And there's 34 polling sites, and then there's 82 precincts.
Is that a lot more than, I guess, other counties?
So there is, as you're thinking this out, you have 82 different ballots, but times two, because one's Republican and one's a Democrat, so we really have 164 different ballots plus two extra. So there's definitely a lot of ballots out there, but it fits for each person. So when you come to vote, you get that precise ballot for where you live. We're not a small county, you know, but if you compare it to Marion County, they have 600 precincts and 300 polling sites, but they're a lot bigger than us. And then you can look at Brown County, and it's going to be a lot smaller. I don't know how many precincts they have.
You had mentioned earlier that polls close at 6 p.m., and then we can start expecting to see results come in as the ballots are being tallied?
You know, when they close, they'll bring in their MBB cards, and we'll get them and put them in the computer. So I would say, you know, we're going to be seeing some results by 8 o'clock. How fast it gets out to the public is depending on how many reports and things that need to be run. This is my first time of being election supervisor, so I don't want to... 8 o'clock should be sufficient, then. I'm going to say that we should have the end results by 8 o'clock. I know, the closing, we have no control over how long it takes for them to close.
The polls will close at 6, but if somebody's standing in line, then they still get to cast their ballot, correct?
Exactly, and then we have that team that's out there and how fast they sign all their paperwork and do their stuff. Some are just faster than others, and...
You had mentioned there's a number of different polling sites. You're expecting those to get completely closed down probably by about 7?
They really should be done by 6:30, and then they have to get in here. But 7 would be very fair.
And how are those results tallied? I mean, when I voted today, I voted on a paper ballot, and then it electronically scanned it in. Does all of that, I guess, go to one central computer or database?
Right. So that scanner, the e-scan, has an MBB card, and that accepts all of that information. When the inspector comes in and the Republican judge, then I will get that MBB card, and we put it into another computer that has never been on the Internet, and we process it that way, and we get our results. So everything is very, very safe. And it's never been out on the Internet.
You had mentioned that there's a judge involved. Is that the, I guess, only oversight except for the workers who are working the polls?
So all the inspectors in Monroe County are Democrats. And so for the inspector to bring back the ballots, he has to have that Republican judge ride with them so that there's a bipartisan team always handling the ballots. They are never out of the sight of a bipartisan team.
Karen Wheeler, Monroe County Elections Supervisor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Wes.
That was WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaking with Monroe County Election Supervisor Karen Wheeler. Registered voters can still cast their ballots in today's midterm primary election until 6 p.m. Those who haven't voted by 6 but are still in line will be allowed to vote. It is illegal to wear political paraphernalia into the voting sites. To find your polling place, visit indianavoters.com.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I am Glenda Murray, and today I want to share information about Maud Showers, one of the strong leaders in Monroe County. Maud was the daughter of a prominent local farmer and landowner. She married Hull Showers, the youngest Showers brother, at age 16 in 1879. Together, they had three children and built a fine home at the corner of 6th and Lincoln, where the city parking lot is now between the History Center and the library. December of 1886, Hull became ill and died, leaving Maud a widow at age 23. But before he died, Hull made a will that gave Maud 1/3 interest in the Showers Company, which at that point was a growing business in town making furniture. Maud probably did not have much formal education, but she was a smart, organized woman, and she grew into one of the leaders of her day. She was active in the local Christian church, in its missionary work, in the temperance campaign against alcohol, and in the Bloomington Equal Suffrage Club. Maud married again in 1890 and moved to Indianapolis, but by 1894, she had lost both of her parents, lost a baby, divorced her husband, moved back to Bloomington, and took back the name Maud Showers. Once she returned, she threw herself back into the community. Her brother-in-law, James Showers, retired from Showers Brothers in 1903, leaving William Showers as president of the company and Maud as the vice president. Between them, they owned the controlling interest in the company. Her daughter and son both became stockholders in later years. Maud was the president of the Local Council of Women from 1903 to 1906. The local council was the umbrella organization for many local women's groups, including the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the YWCA, the Cemetery Association, which led to the fixing up and naming the old graveyard as Rose Hill Cemetery, and many other organizations. The local council supported improvements in sanitation and hygiene, tree and flower planting, education, and charity for those in need. The local council also saw the need for a public hospital and library. By 1905, the need for a hospital was foremost on the local council's mind, and the local council purchased the Hopewell Farm at what is now 2nd and Rogers, converting the two-story red brick house into a hospital for 10 patients. Maud was president of the local council, as I mentioned, and she was also president of the new hospital board. She was also intimately involved in the development of the Carnegie Library to replace what she called, quote, the small library a few women have been conducting in a room in the courthouse, using such books as have been given by various people, largely for children, end quote. Maud married again in 1912. She continued to be active in the community, especially in the hospital and library boards, until her health began to decline in the 1930s. She died in 1936. Her obituary listed the many organizations she had participated in, but instead of listing those for you, I want to close with comments from Carol Krause, who wrote a wonderful book that was published in 2012 about the Showers brothers and what that company and its founding family meant to Bloomington. Carol said, quote, Maud was an intelligent woman, a very good public speaker, a savvy political lobbyist, and an indefatigable campaigner for her host of good causes. Carol continued, the farmer's daughter, who had married at 16, had made it her goal to utilize opportunities to help others who were less fortunate. Maud did more than anyone else in Bloomington, except for the two Showers brothers themselves, to make the city into a much better place than it originally was. End quote. That's quite a legacy, and I thank Carol for writing the book, and I honor Maud Showers for her work over the years. Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jonah Chester and Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welsh, with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Wes Martin. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadeke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Erin Wagermiller.
And I'm Don Guerra. Stay tuned for Counterspin, fairness and accuracy in reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind.